When you hear the word Arab, what sort of person appears in your mind? Arab Women Say What? A new documentary produced by the National Film Board of Canada challenges our preconceptions of the Arabic community, a community which encompasses numerous cultures and countries. Directed by Nisreen Bakker, the film follows eight Arab women as they explore conversations about feminism, community, culture, belonging, and politics. Let's get into it.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on, Ryan. Really excited to be talking to you and to your listeners. And it is a documentary. It's produced by the National Film Board of Canada. And I am eternally grateful for them for producing this. This came about. So, okay, it has a little story, right? So I was in a function at the National Film Board office here in Edmonton. A luncheon, and I was talking to David Christensen, the executive producer at the time, pitching him a completely different project. And then we got to talking, and I was telling him about, I had a gathering with my friends, female friends, and the conversation that went on, because we usually have those regular gatherings. Mm-hmm. And the more I talked, the more he listened intently. And then he pointed, and he said, This is a documentary I'd like to see. And we finished the luncheon and I sprung to work. I talked to my friends. Many of them said, no way, Jose, what do you mean? You put a camera on my face, not doing this. And we're a much bigger group than the eight women in the movie. So many of them said no. And the ones who said yes had, you know, reservations and whatnot. And, you know,
as things like this tend to do.
Yes, yes. I mean, I'm a director, and if you put a camera in my face, I'm not sure I'd be very comfortable, you know. So anyways, we started prepping and getting ready, and the ball got rolling, sent the proposal to NFB, and, you know, we started development, basically, and boom, COVID. Right at where we're going to start filming, we had already talked to the crew, everything is ready to go, COVID, everybody's at home. So my friends and I started gathering on Zoom. And I talked to the producer, Koti, and I said, well, how about we document the time? I mean, everybody's meeting on Zoom. Let's record our Zoom meetings. And she said, okay, out of the box, write it on a proposal and, you know, let's see. And yeah. To their credit, National Film Board indulged me. So the theory was we're going to film the Zooms, record the Zooms, and then we're going to send the women eight phones to record themselves for the one-on-one interview up close and personal. And that was a very lucky thing because right there, they turned from the subject of a documentary to participants in the documentary. They're telling their own story now. They don't have a director and a DOP pointing a camera at them asking questions. They're showing us, telling us what they would like us as the viewers to know about them. They're actually communicating, connecting with the larger Canadian society. We love that. It was difficult as a director to surrender that.
Yeah, you definitely have to be hands-off in that moment. It's like, no, I want to do this. Okay.
Nicely. So it was really an interesting process. Restrictions lifted. So we managed to get to film the women on the first time they met, and I, the first time I see them after 2 years of lockdown, all the emotions, you know, all the missing one another, missing human connection, missing each other as friends, because as immigrants, with time, those friends become family. They're basically compensate for what we miss in the old country.
Yeah, that's something I noticed too when watching it. People talking about their different experiences as newcomers, as immigrants, and trying to find a balance between those two cultures. Like one of the people were saying that when they're here in Canada, they're known as like, you know, this sort of person. But when they go back home, you know, they're seen as Canadian and they never seem to quite fit in at times.
And that's something, I guess it's a first generation immigrant, I would believe, in any background, whether it's Latin America or Africa or Asia or where have you, even in Europe, you somehow don't quite fit into both places because, you know, you adapt, you change, you go with the flow in Canada, which may or may not be the same as what you're used to in your country of origin. Here, yeah, you fitting, but not quite, missing a little bit. And then when you go there, you've already adopted the Canadian way of life. So while you speak the language, you know the tradition, but there is that part.
Yeah, something has just slightly changed.
Exactly. That's gone, lost in translation. So for us friends from, you know, similar background and similar experience, I mean, I have friends from different backgrounds, you know, it's that experience that connects us. And it got me thinking to, would a mainstream Canadian watch this film, see that particular part, and think of their ancestors when they came to Canada? Because that's how they probably felt.
Just as you mentioned that, it's like I didn't have that thought at all, right? Of like what were like my family members who moved here like a couple generations ago, what were their experiences like? Yeah, I'm so integrated into just Canadian life. That's something that didn't even pass my mind.
Yeah, to me, it got me wondering, would that idea occur to anyone watching this who's not a new immigrant, who's been here for generations and generations, that this is sort of an homage to those who came before us, those who built this country? It must, and mind you, there was no Zoom, hardly phones, you know, it was a different time, it must have been really isolating for them.
And I think that goes directly into some of the conversations that were had about integration, assimilation versus integration, right? Like talking about like, how do you become part of a culture while still reflecting your background, your values, versus, you know, someone who kind of completely gives those up when they come to a new country.
That is the beauty of Canada. That's why my husband and I chose Canada, because when we decided, my husband's Palestinian, I'm Egyptian. That's the background. So when we decided to pick a country to call home, we needed a base. We kept moving from one country to the next. So we needed a base. So we educated ourselves, because at that point, the choices were Australia, the United States, and Canada. We decided to educate ourselves and make an informed decision which country that's going to be our forever home. And it was Canada, because of the Bill of Rights and Freedoms, the multicultural heritage of Canada, and that being enshrined into the Canadian Constitution, is what tipped the scale for us. And we said, that's the country we're going for. We're going to apply to that. And it is that mosaic of Canada that makes Canada stand out. It's not a melting pot like the United States, where you have to assimilate. It's rather you need to integrate into Canada, keeping and encourage to keep your culture, keep those parts of your culture that would help Canada thrive. And that's a personal growth. And it's not an easy journey for an immigrant. Not to actually make a conscious decision. Just like Carmen said in the film, I had to review my culture. I had to revisit and see what really fits, what doesn't. How can I, you know, walk that fine line, marry the two cultures, what have you? That's quite a challenge, and it becomes more complicated when you have kids.
Definitely.
Yes.
Well, they're going to school, they're interacting with their friends, and then they see their friends a very specific way. And then you're like, oh, we're going to do this part of our thing from our culture. And they're like, you know, what is that? My friend doesn't do that thing. Why would I want to do that thing too?
Yes. It is quite challenging for parents to raise well-adjusted, well-integrated, heritage-proud kids. Chapeau to them.
You were mentioning that one of the things you're hoping that maybe spark in people's minds is that question of, What was life like for my ancestors and people coming here to Canada that, you know, challenges and isolation is there? What are some other things that you're hoping sparks in people's minds to have conversations after watching this film? I know when I was watching it, I think one of the things that stood out is how important it is to recognize that when you see the word Arab, it doesn't mean a very specific type of person. As we've seen from the 8 women in this film, how diverse the Arabic world is. Like one person just mentions, like, just because I speak Arabic and I'm Arab doesn't mean I'm Muslim.
Sure.
It's so diverse. And I think for a lot of people, they don't think about that. They hear the word Arab and they instantly think, yeah, just Muslim.
So that's one of the things. You know, you're absolutely right. One of the things I'd hope that the audience would get is that that four-letter word, Arab, carries a rainbow of cultures, dialects, religions, with an S, big S, religions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only Christians and Muslims. We have Jewish people. We have Druze. We have Baha'is. The diversity in dialect is to the point where Sana from Morocco, for example, she speaks her dialect. I, as an Egyptian Canadian, could barely understand.
It's like, okay, I can get bits and pieces.
But as Carmen said to Teresa, the traditions are very similar. So you get Eid, which is after Ramadan. Muslims, we do this type of pastry with powdered sugar and whatnot. And Arab Christians, at least in Egypt, Christmas time, they do the same pastry. So there's a lot in common, but we're by no means a monolithic group of people. Within, you know, Arab Muslims, there is a whole spectrum of views that might contradict each other, that might oppose each other, or agree with each other as well.
Exactly.
You know, and you take that to everything.
It's the same thing with like Christianity, right? Like there's so many different denominations where it's like there's an umbrella belief that's very similar, but like how you act on them, different practices and teachings are drastically different.
Yes, yes. So that's, I guess my point in that was we are no different than the next community you meet in Canada or elsewhere for that matter. We carry this variety. We have, you know, as I mentioned, the whole spectrum, the whole rainbow of cultures and dialects and food and tradition and what have you. Unfortunately, mainstream media tend to paint everybody with the same brush.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to mention that, you know, having those conversations, exploring the Ukraine war and then talking about the other wars that affect tons of Middle Eastern countries and how in the media it's like, oh no, the Ukrainians, we got to help them. Whereas in the Middle East, oftentimes the media depicts it as just, you know, this stuff happens there. It's not news.
That's very hurtful. Very, very hurtful. Of course, we need to support the Ukrainians. Of course, their country is, you know, being invaded. How come it's not, of course, when it comes to the Palestinians? I really don't get that. I mean, they're being slaughtered as you and I speak right now, slaughtered,
yeah.
Starved. And yeah, I mean, people out on the streets in every country in the world asking for a ceasefire. It is frightening, actually, to me to see how dismissive politicians worldwide of their constituents. I mean, we elected those people to office and we're asking for something and they're not listening. They're dismissing that. And when they finally listen, it's so watered down, almost useless, meaningless. So it makes me wonder, you know, they came for my brother sort of thing, or they came for my neighbor. So right now it's happening there to the Palestinians. But here in Canada or in the UK or what have you, people are saying, no, stop this. Politicians are not listening. If we set that par, if we said, okay, this is it. Yeah, we talk, you don't listen, but we're going to vote for you. What happens when it comes to our healthcare? They want to change something drastic to our healthcare system. We're out on the
street. Yep. They'll just start making changes because it's like, oh, you know what?
Yeah.
You'll still vote me in anyways. It's exactly. Fine. Like
you're used to it by now. People died. People got killed. Like the worst happened. We carried on business as usual and you accepted. You accepted that we ignored you. So now when it comes to your education system and healthcare system, well, you're used to it. We're going to ignore you. Of course. How is it that us collectively as Canadians, regardless of background, not scared of that? How is it that we think that this is over there?
That it's not going to affect. I think that's the kind of short-sightedness that people can have sometimes. And I think that's the power of documentaries and films that you're creating here, having those conversations, sparking those discussions that things seem miles and miles away. But, you know, atrocities and things are happening directly on our doorstep. Murdered and missing Indigenous women and Two-Spirit folk. The residential school system. Yes. For me, oftentimes it feels like in westernized societies is often treated as like, oh, all these bad things, they don't happen. They don't exist. Well, all the bad things are kind of hidden, discarded to the side that you're like, don't look at that dirty laundry over there. That's nothing to worry about. It's like, wait, but that means this nation is built on lies.
Yes. And facing the mistakes of the past is no easy path. And it's a process. It's a long process. It's not a one-day reconciliation celebration. It's a long, long process. Listening to the people who are affected by this, but really listening, hearing them, really listening. It is them. It is the victims of those atrocities that would guide us to the right way you can't correct the mistakes. What happened, the past happened, but you can certainly improve from now on. You can certainly pay attention. You can compensate. You can, you know, reparation. You can do many, many things. And I think that's one of the reasons why Holocaust survivors and their immediate descendants have been sounding the alarms for years on Israel and what's happening in Israel for years. And collectively, we chose to dismiss them. We chose not to listen until one morning we wake up to more than 30,000 dead.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it is very easy to get comfortable in life, to be like, hey, I'm good right now. Things can be hard sometimes, but you know, if I just kind of put my head down and I'll worry about things, everything's going to be fine. But, you know, sooner or later, especially now that we're a much more connected global society, things affect all of us. The war in Ukraine isn't just affecting Ukrainians. The grain and things that they produce that they can't anymore is affecting tons of different countries that require that. Wars in the Middle East cause refugees, people struggling. Like, imagine a world where, you know, these words weren't happening and countries could thrive and grow, you know, without the baggage of like another topic that was explored, colonialism, imperialism, and how a lot of countries after their resources were used up were just kind of discarded.
Yes, colonialism has devastated so many countries and we can still see the consequences till today. I mean, again, you and I speak right now, and there is a massacre and starvation going in Congo. The colonial powers kind of brought with them all the ailments that Europe suffered from. So anti-Semitism, that is a strictly European phenomenon that was made in Europe. An answer to that was Zionism that seeked to, you know, save the Jews from all this discrimination. Zionism, so anti-Semitism, Europe, Zionism in Europe. And the question with Zionism is where to put, how can we save the Jewish people from all this discrimination? And the suggestions were, let's take them to Argentina, or let's take them to Cyprus, or let's take them to Kenya. Palestine was like an afterthought. You know, that was World War One, when the immigration started, the Balfour Declaration. And here's another question. Balfour, a British guy, what power does he have to give Palestine to another people? It had people. There were Palestinians living there. I mean, those million refugees that were created in 1948 did not come from Mars. They were there in the land. They were kicked out because there's no way that it would sound logical to anybody. If I would tell you, you're living in your house, and then a guest comes around, knocks on your door, and you say, oh, please come in, take my house. I'm going to take my clothes or, you know, whatever you allow me, and I'm going to go live in that tent in that desert, willingly. Does that make sense to anybody? They move?
It definitely does not.
Does it make sense to anybody? So history shows us that during the Roman Empire, Rome occupied the UK. The UK was part of the Roman Empire. Can an Italian person today go knock on somebody's door in the UK and say, yeah, get out. That was my great, 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 great ancestor's house. It's now mine. Get out. Would the UK accept that?
Of course not. Once again, it's that double standard.
Why is it accepted for the Palestinians? Why is that okay to happen to that population? It's the unfairness of the whole thing and how clear the unfairness is that blows my mind. Putin right now is a war criminal. That's it. A decision has been made. The Court of Justice said he's a war criminal. He did not even kill half of the number that the Israeli government killed. And nothing, absolutely nothing.
Dead silence from that end.
So anti-Semitism, Zionism, fascism, those are the three ailments that originated in Europe and were brought to other regions with the colonial powers. Particularly this anti-Semitism thing, you know, as an Arab, I take offense in that because Arabs are Semites. And the accusation of anti-Semitism, this anti-Semitism, that, for disagreeing with a political movement. Zionism is a political movement. If I can agree with Justin Trudeau, the government of Canada, the Liberal Party as a political party, I can certainly disagree with Zionism or the government of Israel. It doesn't say that Israelis are bad or that Jewish people in general are bad. Of course not. That doesn't make sense to anybody. The overuse of anti-Semitism, the conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, waters down the high esteem, the powerfulness of this.
Well, when you throw words around like that all the time, right? Like when you're saying like, this is anti-Semitic, this is anti-Semitic, this is anti-Semitic, eventually those words lose their power and people stop noticing when something is actually anti-Semitic. That, you know, when to start challenging the status quo, if someone just dilutes the waters enough, no one's going to pay attention to what you're saying because you're like, well, it's just once again in the garble. It's like, oh, I've been told everything is anti-Semitic. So like, well, what even does anything mean anymore?
Yes, 100%. And that is very dangerous, not only for the Jewish people, but for all Semites, because I do refuse to surrender my race. You cannot take me out of my race. I'm an Arab. I'm a Semite. So in Europe, it meant anti-Jewish. But when you bring it to the Middle East, where everybody's an Arab or a Semite, you can't bring that with you. You cannot.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense then.
It doesn't. But here in North America, if everything is anti-Semite, as you mentioned, it will lose their power, which will endanger us, the very people we're trying to protect, the Jewish people. You know, so it's just, yeah, conflating things, words and conflating concepts and mixing this and that. I think we need to entangle, make sure that everything is understood for what it is.
And I think that's the power of the message of this film is conversations and I think partially a unity. Tons of different people of different backgrounds coming together, becoming friends, having conversations. And I think that's important, like especially for immigrants and newcomers, you know, having that found community, that found family is so important. And I think COVID was incredibly devastating for community, the separation. A lot of the challenges that we're seeing right now, the political division and the vitriol that we're seeing and hearing, I think is tied to the isolation that people experience. No one feels connected to a community anymore. No one feels like they're part of a broader ideal or system, and it becomes much easier to divide and then manipulate people because of that.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That could be, you know, the aftermath of isolation and COVID that, but my goodness, so 2 years of isolation made us forget about.
I mean, that's just my thought. I don't know. I don't know if there's any studies or anything like that. That's just the vibe that I feel connecting with certain people who were completely disconnected from things. I was lucky enough to have, like you, where you had Zoom and this group of amazing women to connect with. I had a group of amazing friends that I was able to connect with regularly over the internet, you know, to keep yourself grounded when things are spiraling out of control.
Well, I think you're right. There needs to be a study because, yeah, the world after COVID looks, yeah, not a great picture.
I don't want to blame everything on the COVID thing, but I think it's one of many factors that are leading to what we're seeing today.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is one of many, many factors, but I cannot fathom how us collectively are just, yeah, disconnected from something that's happening because we think it's far away. Keep remembering they came for my neighbor.
For people who are watching this film, what do you hope they leave with after watching?
I hope they leave with an opening to a conversation to understand part of the Canadian mosaic that has been misunderstood, demonized, so many misinformation has been brought to our big screens by mainstream media. I hope the next time they hear a story about an Arab, they take a minute to think how true or how exaggerated or could that possibly be. I hope they understand that we are their next door neighbor. We're no different than any other community. I hope they spark a conversation. They start a conversation. They feel empowered to start a conversation with an Arab. Ask us, whatever it is. I heard this on the news. Is that true? Is that how you treat your women? Really? Why do men can marry four in your religion? Where did that come from? And we're happy to explain, you know, because it's not an accusation. You know, it's not your religion does this, and it's why, it's how, it's really building those bridges of understanding. There's a big difference between, you know, so why does your religion do this and that? And could you tell me why is this so in your religion? The difference between someone trying to understand and someone trying to degrade is obvious. You know, it's very, very obvious, and the receiver of that question can immediately tell.
Yeah, well, with things like that, misogyny is everywhere. Like, it's not relegated to one group, one ideology, one religion. It's something that we see all the time, and a big thing talked about in the film, the loss of female reproductive rights. Right now in the United States, some of those conversations happening in Europe as well. So, like, it's breaking those misconceptions that it's like, it's not one group, like this group bad, this group good. Every group, you know, every group has bad people in it, but there's also many, many good things regardless of the group as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's always interesting to me how, especially with African, Canadian, African American, and immigrant community, the one immigrant is taken as representative of that group. I don't represent anybody but myself. We are individual people, whereas mainstream Canadian or mainstream Americans, they are individuals. If somebody does something bad, it's that person, most likely because he has mental issues, but not because he's a terrorist, God forbid, or anything. Now he goes, somebody goes on a rampage killing people in schools, killing kids in schools. Oh, he has mental issues. But if that was an African-American, then he's on drugs, then he stole this, then he was dismissed from school that day.
Angry at the system.
And this is somehow representative of all African-Americans. But that mainstream person who did it, that's his fault. Nobody else's fault. That wide brush and considering the minority individual representative of a minority group, this needs to change. This cannot go on. Unacceptable. Yeah.
It's important to challenge our biases.
Definitely.
Well, Nisreen, an absolute pleasure to connect with you and continue these powerful conversations. And I can't wait for others to get to listen to this group of amazing women have these conversations as well. When does the film come out and where can people watch it?
So it's coming out 10th of April on the National Film Board website. So www.nfb.ca, and look for Things Airwomen, Airwomen Say What? That's because I have another film called Things Airmen Say. It's also on the same website. And because it was also produced by the National Film Board of Canada, I'm eternally grateful for them. For giving us a voice, really good.
Have any stories you'd like us to share or communities we should highlight? Leave a comment on our social media or reach out to us on our website. I'm Ryan Funk. This was You Talk, and have yourself a good one.